content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from The Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassembly.com. Starting today with an article on business and economy, Sunset Sunrise by Greg LaCour. His portrait occupies a prominent place on the wall. The suit is grey, the tie red with diagonal stripes. He returns a viewer's gaze with a direct, beneficent look and a hint of a grin. The fingers of his right hand grasp a book with a deep golden cover. Leon Levine and Family Dollar, an American success story. When he died on April 5th, 2023, at 85, Leon Levine was hailed nationwide as the founder of both a business empire and an eponymous philanthropic organization in Charlotte that granted more than $450 million to healthcare, education, and community causes over 43 years. Levine and his second wife, Sandra, founded the Leon Levine Foundation in 1980, and he devoted himself to it after retiring from Family Dollar in 2003. In an age of tech oligarchs and rapidly accrued millions from nebulous sources, Levine seemed to represent the values of another era, one in which wealth and generosity weren't incompatible. Two things flew out of him, said Michael Tarwater, a friend and former healthcare executive who now serves as the Levine Foundation's board chair. One, he was a businessman. He approached every aspect of his thinking through a business person's mindset, including our philanthropy. But the counterbalance to that was this real sense of humanity and this desire to give back. To give back on a large scale, though, Levine had to accumulate a fortune. He was an aggressive, tough-minded entrepreneur. Family Dollar, which Levine started in a humble storefront on Central Avenue in Charlotte, didn't grow into an $8 billion national retail giant because of his altruism. But the business reflected his concern for people on the economic margins. He followed generations of fellow Jewish merchants in the South who had exercised a lifelong commitment to fair trade and community building. Sell affordable goods to people who need them in the places where they live. Once somebody walks out of a store, they rarely remember how much they paid for something, he once said, but they do remember where they bought it and if it lasts. The two institutions he founded and shepherded had different goals but similar attitudes towards their neighbours. That's why, 3 years after his death, Levine's legacy carries a glaring, even tragic, contradiction. The Leon Levine Foundation, which inherited his wealth, is embarking on a $2 billion effort to help communities in need throughout the Carolinas over the next half century. Meanwhile, under private equity ownership, Family Dollar faces scrutiny for exploiting those same communities. The Southern Jewish Merchant Way. Throughout his life, Levine championed the Jewish concept of Tikkun Olam, Hebrew for world repair. If you're able to improve the world around you, the principle holds, you're obligated to do everything you can. His father, Harry, was one of 10 children who emigrated from Russia with their parents around 1900. The family brought the principle with them across the Atlantic. The 1881 assassination of Tsar Alexander II, falsely blamed on Jews, led to violent attacks and anti-Semitic laws in Russia and ultimately mass emigration. An estimated 2.5 million Eastern European Jews poured into the United States between the 1880s and the mid-1920s. Some of them, including the Levines, worked their way south, rather than establishing homes and businesses in the Northeast. Many of their forebears had been itinerant peddlers who travelled from village to village, selling inexpensive goods to people who couldn't afford better. Jewish immigrants adopted some of the same patterns in the post-Civil War South, where they loaded up carts in the region's new whistle-stop towns. During the Jim Crow era, the wealthy white landowners who owned the largest businesses wouldn't sell to black customers or would price goods out of their reach. Jewish merchants were often their only source of affordable essentials, like flour, farm equipment, and work clothes. Some Jewish stores even extended credit to black patrons, an unheard-of practice among white merchants. Over the decades, a bond developed. The Jewish immigrant had never seen black men before, wrote Eli N. Evans in The Provincials, A Personal History of Jews in the South, published in 1973. He was more willing to respond out of actual experience with the Negro than out of a twisted history of slavery, guilt, and pathological hate. The Levines lived and worked within that tradition. After Harry Levine's discharge from the army in 1919, he and his wife Minnie settled in Rockingham, a small textile town about 70 miles east of Charlotte. They bought a modest, whitewashed craftsman-style house with a gabled roof and eventually raised four children, Dorothy, Sherman, Alvin, and Leon. In 1921, Harry bought a downtown building from another Jewish merchant, Abram Aronson, and turned it into a department store, the Hub. All the Levine children got their first real work experience at the Hub, and all four would later go into retail themselves. Even as a child, Leon Levine understood the necessity of hard work. Some of his earliest memories were of cleaning coal ash from the family's basement furnace and displaying a penchant for the hard-headed deal. When he was about nine, his older brothers left him at home while they took a day trip to the beach. Leon was so furious, he broke his piggy bank, counted about $13 in pennies, and took a taxi there. It wasn't enough to cover the fare, Leon later remembered, but the driver figured he could get my father to give him something from the store for the rest. Rockingham, a town of about 9,000 today, remembers and honours the Levine's family legacy, especially Leon's. On a sunny April day, John Hutchinson, Rockingham's mayor and avid amateur historian, guided me on a walking tour of the town's sites linked to Levine, including Discovery Place Kids, an interactive children's museum to which the Levine Foundation contributed a $2 million grant. There are a lot of people who've come from here who became successful, Hutchinson told me as we walked, but not all of them have reached back and continued to make a difference like Leon Levine did. Charlotte and the rise of Family Dollar. In 1949, when Leon was 12, his father died of a heart attack. Sherman and Minnie ran the Hub for the next 11 years, and Leon helped, especially after Sherman was drafted into the army and shipped off to Korea. By the late 1950s, however, Minnie and her sons were ready to leave Rockingham for the big city, Charlotte. Alvin, the middle son, was first. He co-founded the Pick and Pay shoe store with Albert Siegel, Dorothy's husband, on Charlotte's Central Avenue in 1957. 2 years later, his brother Sherman opened a clothing shop, Sherman's Limited, on the same block. Discount retail was just the beginning to settle in, into its economic niche. Leon Levine, then 22, had recently learned about a Kentucky chain that sold nothing for more than $1. He liked the low operational costs, but found the $1 limit too confining. He set the cap at $2, then $3 soon after. But Levine still wanted dollar in the name. He went through dozens of options before he chose the one that sounded right. He opened the first Family Dollar in November 1959. A Charlotte Observer photograph from June 1960 shows the three Levine brothers arm in arm striding down the sidewalk in front of Sherman's Limited. They were on their way. Leon Levine never strayed from his bedrock vision of what a Family Dollar should be. Clean, well-lit, and a discount store in low- to middle-income neighborhoods that operated on a cash-and-carry model to keep costs down. I knew who my customers were, he said later, and I bought merchandise based on what they wanted. He famously scouted store locations by checking supermarket parking lots for oil stains. If the neighborhood had enough people who drove old, leaky cars, he reasoned, it was the right place for a family dollar. Our customers, he recalled, didn't drive Cadillacs. His was a version of the old railroad town Jewish merchant's ethos, updated for the post-World War II economic boom. And it flourished as other retailers relocated to the more affluent suburbs. By 1966, Family Dollar operated 27 stores in four states, with annual gross sales exceeding $5 million. That year, Levine absorbed another personal blow. Barbara, his wife of 8 years and mother of their three children, died of breast cancer at 27. But Levine kept working, eventually outpacing his two brothers. Sherman's Limited lasted for only a few years, and Sherman later joined Family Dollar as an executive. Alvin had more success, turning Pick and Pay into a nationwide brand before he sold it in 1979. Having gone public in 1970, Family Dollar made the Fortune 500 in 1995. By 2003, when Levine retired and passed the chairmanship to his oldest son, Howard, the chain had grown to 4,700 stores in more than 40 states and rewarded shareholders with 27 consecutive years of rising profits. Today, despite its 7,000 stores nationwide, the retailer's prospects are far dimmer than they were a decade ago. Worse, its relationship with the communities where the stores are, a guiding principle from the beginning, flies in the face of Leon Levine's original vision. I don't think it's going to end well. In 2015, Virginia-based Dollar Tree acquired Family Dollar for $8.5 billion after a long and ferocious bidding war with its chief rival, Dollar General. Dollar Tree cast the merger as a transformational step toward creating a top discount retailer that could compete more effectively against Dollar General's growing empire. The merger included Howard Levine's appointment to the company's board of directors. Almost exactly a decade later, the transformation fell apart. In March 2024, the company announced that it would close 1,000 Family Dollar stores. On July 7, 2025, Dollar Tree said it would sell Family Dollar to a pair of private equity firms for $1 billion, a fraction of what it had paid. Industry experts said the company struggled with operational issues and poor store locations. Basically, Dollar Tree bit off far more than it could chew, said Neil Saunders of Global Data. By then, Howard Levine was long gone. He left the company in January 2016 after helping complete the merger. The purpose and public perception of discount retailers like Family Dollar had also turned. The shift began in the 1980s, as Walmart expanded from a few hundred stores to more than 1,000, said Rick Niswander, an accounting professor emeritus at East Carolina University, who's closely tracked the discount retail industry for the past decade. Other retail outlets expanded, but they cut costs too, which led to a decline in service and quality. Customer bases dwindled, and traditional discount stores began to peel away from their communities. Private equity firms raise money from investors to buy struggling companies, restructure the companies to make more money, then sell them at a profit within a few years. Once they entered the picture, as in the 2025 Family Dollar sale, any lingering sense of social responsibility disappeared. Researchers and community groups have found that discount retailers in low-income areas create food deserts and undercut local entrepreneurs. They, and private equity owners in general, are sometimes compared to swarms of locusts that strip acquired assets of value, then move on to others. Niswander underscored the importance of community relationships in the old model, where retailers have some consideration of societal issues. If they do something totally stupid, their shareholders can start to try to kick out the executives, he explained. If you're in private equity, none of that stuff is there. Their purpose is to increase margins and cut costs. In March, for example, news outlets reported that Family Dollar plans to close a Matthews distribution centre and cut 373 jobs. I don't think it's going to end well for Family Dollar as a name, Niswander said. It'll probably take 3, 4, 5 years to happen, but you can't totally cut your way to success. More troubling, a December 2025 investigation by The Guardian revealed that Family Dollar and its rival Dollar General regularly overcharge customers in low-income neighbourhoods. Since January 2025, Family Dollar stores had failed more than 2,100 government price accuracy inspections in 20 states. The inspections flag when goods are listed at one price on the shelf but ring up at higher prices at the register, discrepancies that shoppers seldom notice. Dollar General was even worse. It failed more than 4,300 inspections in 23 states over the same period. The Levine family long ago cut formal ties with Family Dollar. Still, the brand and Leon Levine are forever linked. As we sat in the Leon Levine Foundation's conference room where his portrait hangs, I asked Foundation leaders, does it rankle to see what Family Dollar has become? Is it fair to see that as part of Levine's legacy too? The questions prompted an awkward silence. Tarwater, the board chair, was at the table along with President and CEO Tom Lawrence and Senior Vice President Justin Steinschreiber. Tarwater finally broke the tension with a direct gaze and an edge to his voice. When the private equity firms that bought out those retail outlets establish a foundation to give back to the communities they serve, then you can make a comparison. But we'll both be 6 feet under, with daisies growing up above us before that happens, he said. It's a different mindset about how to run a business and a different mindset about serving communities. Prominent business schools, Tarwater said, used to teach people how to be great businessmen. At some point, they taught people how to rip other people off. Family Dollar's corporate office, now in Chesapeake, Virginia, did not respond to an emailed request for comment. A private public life. Today, the Levine name adorns so many institutions, buildings and public spaces in the Carolinas that the foundation doesn't even keep track of them all. The Levine Museum of the New South, Atrium Health Levine Cancer Institute, the Sandra and Leon Levine Jewish Community Center, among others. But Leon Levine himself rarely granted interviews. In 1987, his daughter, Mindy, died by suicide, which led the family to help fund a mental health treatment center in Davidson. A Charlotte Observer profile that year described him as shy, retiring, and obsessively private. Philanthropy was something he did, not something he talked about, even though he knew his name could draw investment dollars, like Atrium Health Levine Children's Hospital, which opened in 2007. To which Levine committed an initial $10 million. As Tarwater put it, Levine simply wasn't a big fan of tooting his own horn. Levine passed on both his commitment to philanthropy and his disdain for publicity to his surviving family. Levine's son, Howard, and daughter, Laurie, went on to found their own philanthropic organizations. Amy, his only child with Sandra, joined the board of a non-profit that supports the families of children with congenital heart disease. All three either declined or did not respond to interview requests. Until recently, even the Levine Foundation copied Levine's reticence. Through a Levine Foundation spokesman, Sandra Levine, the foundation's chair emerita, declined to be interviewed for this story. Only in May 2025 did the organization hire its first communications director. That happened in part because the foundation decided it had its own story to tell. The Dawn of Sunrise. In a rare 2009 interview, as the nation reeled from the previous year's financial crisis, Levine said that all of his and Sandra's wealth would go to the foundation. "My children don't need any more money. They're comfortable," he told the Charlotte Observer. The foundation's assets, worth about $700 million before Levine's death, swelled to $2 billion after it, and foundation leaders had to figure out the best ways to spend that money. Last summer, they announced the largest initiative in the foundation's 45-year history, a campaign to spend the $2 billion in grants over 50 years across the foundation's missions areas of healthcare, human services, education, and Jewish values. Some philanthropic organizations operate on a perpetual endowment model that distributes charitable funds indefinitely. Others choose to spend down their assets over a set time, then close, which allows them to have to achieve the greatest impact. These are typically referred to as sunsets. The Levine Foundation deliberately named its new effort Sunrise to signal what they see as a new day in its history and they hope for people and communities in need throughout the Carolinas. Foundation leaders are still determining which specific projects the effort will target. They'd rather not restrict themselves or the organizations that might apply for grants. "We're still at the very beginning," Lawrence said, noting it will not just be spending to spend. He did say that affordable housing, perhaps the most dire civic issue in Charlotte and other cities, will remain a priority. Just last year, the foundation awarded grants totaling $3 million to help seniors age in place in Forsyth County and $2 million to expand the Charlotte area's Habitat for Humanity building program. But recently, foundation leaders realized they would have to talk more openly about Sunrise and its connection to Levine's legacy. "The Levine name, prominent as it is, signifies little to a flood of Charlotte newcomers who don't know its history. They may not know about the mass Jewish immigration in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, or how the Levines and others settled in places like Rockingham, or about Tikkun al-Olam. They may never have thought about how someone can do both well and do good." As the years pass, the people at the Levine Foundation who knew the man personally have to tell his story to new hires who didn't. That's how about half of the foundation's 30 staff members. To make his memory more real, they participate in intimate community projects. Just a few days before I spoke with Lawrence again, members had helped clean, repair and sort donated books for Promising Pages, a Charlotte nonprofit that directs books to the homes of underserved children. "It gives us the chance to really talk about him and who he was for a few minutes," Lawrence said. The staff does it every year in April to mark the anniversary of Levine's death. "It's a priority for us," Lawrence said, "to make sure that he is known as a man, not a portrait." A change of pace now for a short article about health care. Affordable Care Act enrollment dropped in almost every North Carolina county this year, and this is by Jacob Bieber and Hale Gabrielle Zulueta. Enrollment in health plans under the Affordable Care Act declined in nearly every North Carolina county this year, according to preliminary data released by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in March. Already, early 2026 data showed North Carolina recorded the sharpest drop nationwide in residents enrolling, a drop-off largely attributed to Congress allowing COVID-era premium subsidies to expire. Only two counties, both in far western North Carolina, saw increases in 2026 in the number of people enrolling. As NC Local previously reported, the expiration of enhanced health care premium subsidies at the federal level likely drove a sharp statewide enrollment decline. As costs increased without additional funding through the subsidies, some North Carolinians had to opt out of health care coverage. Preliminary data released in January showed that North Carolina recorded 214,000 fewer Affordable Care Act enrollments this year compared to 2025, about a 22% decline, the largest drop in the country. explore, well, there is a map here, an interactive map, to see how many people enrolled in the ACA healthcare coverage, but obviously I can't show you that. So the key takeaways, all but two North Carolina counties saw enrollment declines, according to an NC Local analysis. Cherokee County experienced a 26% enrollment increase, according to the data, while its neighbor to the west, Clay County, saw a 67% increase. It's unclear what caused the jump. Edgecombe County in eastern North Carolina experienced the steepest decline, with more than 55% drop in 2026 compared to the year before. In 2025, the rural county of 49,000 people tallied more than 5,300 enrollments, or 11% of residents. In 2026, nearly 3,000 fewer people enrolled, according to the data. Last year, more than 975,000 North Carolina residents, about 9% of the state's population, enrolled in coverage under the ACA. Nationally, fewer than 23 million people enrolled in healthcare coverage under the ACA for 2026, according to CMS data. In 2025, more than 24 million enrolled, so it's a drop of about a million. Still, these preliminary figures don't reflect individuals who might have dropped their ACA coverage in 2026, which experts feared would happen as out-of-pocket costs increased. Earlier this year, Notice reported that more than one in five people who signed up through the federal marketplace healthcare.gov, which is used in North Carolina, were dropped from plans because they didn't pay the first month's premium. The report cited internal CMS documents. Additionally, many people who enrolled this year were forced to pay more for the same coverage or choose more affordable options with higher deductibles. Preliminary CMS data illustrate that trend, according to an NC Local analysis, with some North Carolina counties seeing an average out-of-pocket cost increase as high as 30% more compared to last year. If you've lost coverage, KFF Health News recommends discussing private pay or other financial options with your medical provider and looking for cost-saving measures on prescription drug expenses. Meanwhile, some people are choosing to purchase short-term policies which have coverage limitations and fewer protections. Community health centers which treat patients regardless of ability to pay are another option. Local health departments may also provide access to services for uninsured or underinsured people. Some professional associations are providing plan options for their members. For example, NC Realtor, a trade association for thousands of realtors, offers Anthem healthcare plans for purchase by members. The NC Dental Society also offers plans for members. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The Assembly. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments or requests about in-depth North Carolina reporting, please call 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138.